Well, today we begin a new series in the Gospel of John. Now, what do you make of John's Gospel? It's very different, isn't it, from Matthew, Mark and Luke. There's a different tone, atmosphere, feel about the book. And the discussion and sayings which we meet in Matthew, Mark and Luke, we don't find in John. And the discussions and sayings we find in John, we don't find in Matthew, Mark and Luke. And so often in John, we feel ourselves at the very limits of what language can express. Jesus' words are simple, and yet they are profound. They're direct, and yet they're abstract. And we feel that language is being stretched to its very limits. So even the opening words, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." Very simple words. No big words there, are there? And yet, immediately we says that things are here out of our reach. Beyond our comprehension, the very opening words, "In the beginning." And we feel out of our depth. And it's not surprising, is it, when we come to John, that it's like that. Because time and time again, John's language is about the internal workings of the Godhead. About the relationship between the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. And yet as we come to John's Gospel, though we feel out of our depth, there is something very familiar about John's style. John's style is journalistic. He records dialogue verbatim. He records incidents as they unfold. He reports accurately key events and sayings in the life of Jesus. And so when we get near the end of the book, he says, "And truly Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written, you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name." John develops a literary genre 1700 years before that genre was developed. His writings are unlike any other ancient writings. He doesn't write like the ancient writers wrote. He's not copying a style of the time. He's developing his own style. Now, I know journalism has a bad name, but in the true sense of the word, this is an accurate, detailed account of what happened by the man who was there. And he says that, doesn't he? He says, when he tells us about the Christ's death on the cross, he says, "He who has seen has testified, and his testimony is true." And he knows that he's telling the truth, he goes on to say, "so that you may believe." So John's Gospel. Now, key to understanding any book is its structure, its framework. Now, Sophie has started her teacher training. When she was 3, she wrote her first story. This is her first story, age 3. "Once upon a time, there was a sheep. The sheep ran away. The sheep ran and ran." Now, the story has a structure, doesn't it? There's a beginning. The scene is set. Once upon a time, there was a sheep. And then there's a middle. What happened to the sheep? The sheep ran away. And then there's a conclusion. The sheep ran and ran. The sheep disappears over the horizon. Do you see? It's a narrative with a structure. So what's John's structure? What's his beginning, middle, and end? Well, actually, it's not easy to see. Because there are a number of lines and structures within John's overall framework. There's a chronological structure. That's the flow of time. There's a geographical structure, where things take place. There's a structure that's developed around events. The Jewish feasts, the signs that Jesus performed. There's also a structure around the I ams of Jesus. I am the bread of life. I am the vine. I am the way. It's a bit like looking at a carpet and trying to pick out the pattern. Because you look at the carpet, you can see a number of patterns. And each of those patterns is beautiful, and each of those patterns seems to harmonize with other patterns, but you can't quite make out what the overall pattern of the carpet is. You just take a step back and to see how all those other patterns unite into a pattern that holds it all together. Well, can we do that with John's Gospel? As we look at all the different patterns that weave its way through the Gospel, can we take a step back and see a pattern which unites all the other patterns? Or perhaps we can. So let's look at the overall structure of John's Gospel. Now, if I had a PowerPoint, this would be much easier, because we could put it up on the board just for 2 minutes, and we could just look at the structure very simply. So maybe we'll have to remedy that. So let's look at the structure of John's Gospel. Let's begin at the beginning, shall we? So come with me to John chapter 1. Now, John's Gospel begins with a prologue, begins with an introduction. It's a setting of the scene. And that's chapter 1, verses 1 to 18. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him nothing was made that was made. And of course the Word, who is face to face with God, and who is himself God, as you read down, he becomes flesh. God the Son becomes a man without ceasing to be God. He comes from the bosom of the Father to make the Father known. And says John, we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. But I want to focus on two words that are repeated in the prologue, which then John fleshes out through the rest of his gospel. One of those words occurs in the prologue 6 times. John is making a point. So what's the word? The word is light. Verse 4, in him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it or overcome it. There was a man sent from God, whose name was John. This man came for a witness, to bear witness of the light, that all through him might believe. He was not that light, but was sent to bear witness of that light. That was the true light, which gives light to every man coming into the world. See it again and again and again. Light, 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 says John, setting his scene. And the light shines in the darkness. And the darkness did not comprehend it. The light shines. So the other word is darkness. And as the light shines, the darkness does not overcome it. And there you have it. That's the unifying pattern that you find in John. Light, darkness. Light, darkness. You'll find it repeated all the way through the gospel. So come to the next section, chapter 1, verses 19 to 51. And this section brings us up to the beginning of chapter 2. It prepares us for the coming of the light. So John the Baptist says, this is him. The descending spirit says, this is him. Andrew and Peter, Philip and Nathaniel, they say, this is him. It's all preparatory. And so with the next section, chapter 2 to chapter 4, verse 54, what do we witness? We witness the light bursting onto the scene. And in fact, if we had time, we could see how John develops this. Because if you look in chapter 1, John keeps talking about days. And then when he comes to chapter 2, verse 1, he talks about the third day. It's all preparatory to let you know that here comes the light. This section, the light is shining. Well, if the light shines, it shines through the darkness. So how is the light received? Well, the light is received very well. As the light begins to shine, there's blessing, success. So chapter 2, verse 11, he turns water into wine. This beginning of signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Verse 23, now when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover during the feast, many believed in his name when they saw the signs which he did. Chapter 3, verse 2. This talking about Nicodemus, this man came to Jesus by night and said to him, Rabbi, we know that you are a teacher come from God, for no one can do the signs that you do unless God is with him. Chapter 3, verse 26. And they came to John the Baptist, and said to him, Rabbi, he who was with you beyond the Jordan, to whom you have testified, behold, he is baptizing, and all are coming to him. And John, he can't contain himself. He says, verse 29, therefore this joy of mine is fulfilled. And he goes on to say, he must increase, I must decrease. The sense from John is, he's saying, job done. I'm the one who's prepared for his coming. Now he's come, and everyone's going to him. Job done. And then chapter 4, we have this episode in Samaria, the woman at the well. And eventually a whole village come to believe in Jesus. And we're told they believe that he's the saviour of the world. And after that you have the nobleman's son. After the nobleman's son is healed, the whole of the noble and his household, they believe on Jesus. Chapter 4, verse 53. It's more success. So as the light begins to shine, initially it's well received. Initially the light breaks through the darkness. Jesus' ministry is launched with a series of triumphs. But the clues are there. But the darkness won't just retreat. Chapter 3, verse 19 says, Jesus, this is the condemnation, that light has come into the world, and men loved darkness rather than light, because their deeds were evil. For everyone practicing evil hates the light and does not come to the light lest his deeds should be exposed. So it all starts off with great encouragement. The light is well received, but the clues are there that it's not going to go on like that because men hate the light. And so when we come to the next section of the book, chapter 5, verse 1 to chapter 10, verse 22, we might say the empire strikes back. The light is shining, but the opposition is growing. Now, some people make up their minds quickly. Chapter 5, verse 16. For this reason, the Jews persecuted Jesus and sought to kill him because he had done these things on the Sabbath. So some come to a very quick conclusion and reject him. But others are full of questions. This is a time of debate, discussion, argument. People are reacting to Jesus. They're making an assessment of what they see and what they hear and are coming to their own conclusion. Who is he really? And so we find there's disquiet. Chapter 6, verse 60. Therefore many of his disciples, when they heard this is Jesus' uncompromising statement that he's the bread of life, and you've got to eat the bread of life, you've got to eat my flesh and drink my blood. Very uncompromising words. They say, this is a hard saying, who can understand it? When Jesus knew it in himself, that his disciples complained or murmured about this, he says to them, does this offend you? So there's disquiet, offense. There's also debate. Chapter 7, verse 12, and there was much complaining among the people concerning him. Some said, he's good. Others said, no, on the contrary, he deceives the people. He's having a polarizing effect upon the nation. And there are people who just don't know what to think. So chapter 7, verse 40. Therefore many from the crowd, when they heard this saying, said, truly this is the prophet. Others said, this is the Christ, because they weren't sure whether the prophet and the Christ were the same people. But others said, will the Christ come out of Galilee? Has not the scripture said that the Christ comes from the seed of David and from the town of Bethlehem where David was? So there was a division among the people because of him. And then in chapter 8, we have this great declaration by Jesus, verse 12, I am the light of the world. There it is again, you see, I'm the light. And it provokes all sorts of questions and ultimately a hostile response. And yet, through it all, John just drops in very carefully. Chapter 7, verse 51, Nicodemus says, hold on, don't jump to conclusions. Don't be too fast to make up your mind about this Jesus. And in chapters 9 and 10, the arguments, they rage on. Some people see. Eyes are opened. Some people who say they can see can't see. They refuse to see. So it's a time where the light and the darkness are competing with each other. And the argument is shifting this way, that way, this way, that way. And so we come to the next section, chapter 10, verse 22 to chapter 11, verse 57. And by now, as we come to John's Gospel, we find the lines have hardened. The debates finish. The discussions are over. And they say to Jesus, chapter 10, verse 24, come on, give us a straight answer. How long will you keep us in suspense? If you are the Christ, tell us plainly. Are you the Christ? Debate, discussion, over. Come on, tell us. Be straight with us. But of course, what Jesus means by the Christ and what the Jews mean by the Christ are two completely different things. So Jesus can't say, no, I'm not the Christ, because that's not true. But he can't say, yes, I am the Christ, because they'll get the wrong end of the stick. So instead he raises the stakes. And he says, chapter 10, verse 30, I and my Father are one. Are you the Christ? I'll give you a bigger answer than that. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And now Jesus puts that statement in his own words. I and my Father are one. It's a claim to deity. And the Jews understand, which is why we read they pick up stones to stone him. Do you see? The light is shining, but the light is rejected. Chapter 10, verse 39, they try to arrest him. Chapter 11, after the raising of Lazarus from the dead, what do they do, verse 53? They plot to put Jesus to death. Incredible, isn't it? Whereas at the beginning, when they saw the miracles, they believe. Now when they see the miracles, they're more determined to put him to death. The miracles now have a negative effect because the darkness is resisting the light. The opposition is now clear and unequivocal. The battle lines are drawn. The previous section, the darkness was resisting the light. It was pushing back. The empire strikes back. But now it isn't just resisting the light, it's actually on the offensive. Here is a conscious rejection of the light. And so we come to the next phase of John's Gospel, chapter 12, verse 1, chapter 12, verse 50. It's a section on 6 days of preparation leading up to the Passover. Chapter 2, verse 4, Jesus says, my hour has not yet come, but now the hour has come. He's anointed at Bethany in preparation for his coming death. He enters Jerusalem in triumph, but no one understands the significance. We're told, verse 16 of chapter 12, his disciples did not understand these things at first. But when Jesus was glorified, then they remembered that these things were written about him and that they had done these things to him. Jesus now declares, chapter 12, straightly, I'm going to die. And he says, verses 35 and 36, the light will be with you only a little while longer. So the light has been shining gloriously. The only begotten Son of God. He who is in the bosom of the Father. He's come from the light. He's come from the glory. He's come to the darkness of this world. And the light has been shining. I am the light of the world. Shining beautifully, brilliantly, gloriously. But the world has decided to reject the light. Verse 37 of chapter 12. But although he had done so many signs before them, they did not believe in him. And then Jesus spells it out, you can read it later, verse 44 to verse 50 of chapter 12. He talks about light, darkness, darkness, rejecting the light. Verse 46, I have come as a light into the world, that whoever believes in me should not abide in darkness. The world is under darkness. I've come as the light, come to me and you'll live in the light. But the world has made up its choice because the world hates the light. Men love the darkness because their deeds are evil. And so Jesus' dealings with the world are over. And he withdraws. Verse 36 of chapter 12. These things Jesus spoke and departed and was hidden from them. The light now withdraws. So where does Jesus withdraw to? Well, we come to the next section, chapter 13 to 17. He withdraws to the upper room. with this little circle of disciples, with those the Father has given to him. And to this little group, the embryo church, Jesus unveils himself. We're not standing, as it were, at the boundaries of the light. We come in chapters 13 to 17 to the very heart of the light. And we see the glory. We see here the beloved, the husband, with his bride. Well, the next section, chapters 18 and 19, is his passion, his death. And then, chapter 20, the gospel climaxes with his resurrection. So do you see the structure? Chapter 1, verses 1 to 18, it's the prologue. It introduces us to light and darkness. Then there's chapter 1, verses 19 to 51. The light begins to shine. Various witnesses are called to bear testimony. Here's the light, get ready. Chapter 2, verse 1 to chapter 4, verse 54. The light breaks into the darkness, and initially it's very well received. But the clues are there that it's not going to be like that. And then in chapter 5, verse 1 to chapter 10, verse 21, we have this time where the light and darkness are competing with each other. Some people make up their minds very quickly, other people don't. Nicodemus says, hang on, slow down. Don't come to a conclusion too quickly. Assess, look, watch, think. And then we come to chapter 10, verse 22 to 11, verse 57. The darkness now assaults the light. The world's made up its mind. When they see glorious miracles, it only hardens their heart that he must be destroyed. And then chapter 12, verse 1 to chapter 12, verse 50, the light then withdraws from the darkness. And in chapters 13 to 17, the light is now revealed or confined to the church, to the people of God, to those whom the Father has given to him, the community of the elect. And then in chapters 18 and 19, the darkness quenches the light. The darkest chapters. The whole world lies under darkness. The light apparently has been extinguished. The Son of God put to death. But then we have chapter 20, don't we? The resurrection. Where light bursts from the tomb and triumphs over the darkness. John's Gospel is a book about the conflict between the light and the darkness. That's why in John's Gospel you'll find there are so many allusions to light and darkness. I mean, there's one in chapter 13, for example. Chapter 13, verse 30. Judas, having received the piece of bread, he went out immediately and it was night. Well, it was night. John is saying it was night, but he's making a point, isn't he? Because Judas is leaving the circle of light and going out into the darkness. Or when Jesus is standing by the Sea of Tiberias on that resurrection, when the disciples have been out fishing, it's after the resurrection, he stands on the seashore and they can't quite see who it is. It's the grey of the morning. It's not clear. There's a figure on the seashore. Who is it? But of course the sun is rising. The dawn is coming. And by the end of that time, they're sitting around him, conversing, communing with him. Now John throws these things in because it was the dawn, because it was night, but he's making a point. He's using those occurrences that actually happened to make his point. Light, darkness, the coming of the dawn, things becoming clearer to see. Which means, brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, young people, when you read John's Gospel, you can never be neutral. Have you ever noticed the language of John? It's like a court case. A lot of forensic language, a lot of court case language John uses. Why? Because it is a court case. It's exactly the point he's trying to make. Here is a court of law. The claim is made. What is the claim? That Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. So witnesses are called. There's John the Baptist, Moses, There's John himself. He was a witness. There's Christ's works. There is Christ himself, his words, bearing testimony to himself. And of course, supremely, there is the testimony of the Father. And who is sitting in judgment upon the claims of Christ? It's the world. And as the case proceeds, as the light shines, as evidence is piled up, so you can only come to the conclusion and conviction that here is the light, that Jesus' claims are true, so step by step, the world comes to its verdict. And its verdict is to reject Jesus' claims and put him to death. But actually, it's the other way round. You think it's a court case with Christ in the dock. But actually, the world is in the dock. And by rejecting the light, the world condemns itself. But you see, as you read John's Gospel, the court case continues. Every time you read John's Gospel, the court case is being replayed. You're sitting there. You're being called to come to a verdict. What do you think about this Jesus? You've heard the witnesses. You've seen Jesus in the pages of this book. What do you say? What's your verdict? And of course, says John, if you reject the light, you think you're standing in judgment over Jesus, you know better, you see through him, actually you condemn yourself. And it's because you love the darkness. But of course, if looking at the Son of God, you see he is the light of the world. And you come into that light. You're not condemned. And you're saved. So do you see? It is a court case. But actually it's not Jesus who's in the dock. Every time we read it, we're in the dock. What verdicts have we come to? That's why Jesus says, he who believes in him is not condemned. But he who does not believe is condemned already, because he has not believed in the name of the only begotten Son of God. And this is the condemnation, that light has come into the world. It's plain, it's obvious, everybody can see it. And men love darkness. It wasn't because they couldn't see the light. They saw it all right, but they loved the darkness rather than the light, because their deeds were evil. So every time you read through John, you're being called to come to a verdict. You are in the dock. So what is your verdict? What do you say of this Jesus? What do you make of his claims? Do you reject them? Or do you come in worship and devotion and bow the knee? A summary of John's Gospel. So what are we doing in our series? We're not going to look at the whole of the Gospel. What we're going to do is we're going to take our seat with the disciples in the upper room. So this is going to be a series on chapters 13 to 17. Chapter 13, verse 1 reads this: Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, and that he should depart from this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. It's saying that Jesus is away from all the hatred of the world. He's now with his little flock, those with whom the Father has given to him. Here's the church in miniature. Here are the first fruits of a great harvest. And so as Jesus unveils himself to his little flock, as he unveils himself to his people, so, brothers and sisters, he unveils himself to us. Chapters 13 to 17 are the bridegroom with his bride. The world is outside. He's in with those who he loves. He loved them to the end. He loved them intimately. They're his people. It's the bridegroom with his bride. And here is Jesus' word to us all. And yet, even with the church. There is a traitor who must be expelled. Well, we're virtually at the end of what we have to say this morning, but just in the time that remains, just a few brief words on chapter 13. We're going to come back to chapter 13 next week, God willing, but just a few brief words on chapter 13 this morning. So just have chapter 13 open in front of you. It's the evening. We know it's the evening because verse 30 tells us that when Judas went outside, it was night. So here's the evening. The Passover feast lies before us. Jesus with his disciples, they recline on mats around a low table. We're told, verse 2, that Judas is among them. And contrary to our translation, verse 2, this is during supper. It says in our translation, supper being ended. It's during supper. Better translation. Better text. Verse 3. Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going to God. So Jesus has all authority and power at his disposal. Knowing the Father had given all things into his hands. He has all power, all authority. What does he do? Does he thrust Judas from his presence with a look? No. Verse 4, he rose from supper, laid aside his garments, took a towel and girded himself, wrapped it round himself. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. He washes his disciples' feet, including the feet of Judas. And then, verse 12, we're told, when he had washed their feet, taken his garments, and sat down again. So what's going on? Well, you see, I know, we read at the beginning. We're told what's going on. But is that what's going on? Look at verse 7. Jesus says to Peter, what I am doing, you do not understand now, but you will know after this. He's just saying, you'll know after this in about 10 minutes' time when I give the explanation. Will you understand then? I don't think he's talking about that. He's saying there's something else going on here, Peter, which you won't understand till after my resurrection and my ascension. Do you understand what's going on? What's Jesus doing? Why is John so keen to spell out the details? Why doesn't he simply say Jesus washed his disciples' feet? Why does he spell out the details? Look at it. He says, the Father has given all things into his hands. Jesus then leaves his place. He lays aside his garments. He takes the form of a slave. He makes the unclean clean by washing their feet. He then puts his garments back on and sits down again, assuming his rightful place. Do you see the significance? Do you see what's really going on? It's a summary of Jesus' whole mission. His coming into the world, his death upon the cross, and his ascension into glory. Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands. So all authority is given into the hands of the Son. But how does he use those hands? How does he use his divine authority? Well, he leaves his place in heaven. He lays aside the garments of his glory. He takes the form of a slave. And as a slave, he does what is necessary to make his people clean so his people can sit with him at his table. And then he returns to his seat in glory. That's why I read Philippians 2 at the start. Here is the story of redemption. And it's acted out in the washing of the disciples' feet. What I am doing, you do not understand now, but you will know after this. So, Christian friend, do you understand? Here is God. The universe should revolve around him. But instead, he makes his existence revolve around us. He comes as a servant. And he does everything necessary, everything that needs doing, to make us clean. And so the slave is obedient, even to the death of the cross, so that we can take our seat at the table of his love forever. Well, God willing, we'll think more about chapter 13 next week. But let's not rush to an application. Let's not try and bolt this down with do's and don'ts. In the summer, we climbed a high hill. Our legs were tired and our feet were sore. But what did we do when we got to the top of the hill? We just looked and drank in the view. We didn't need to talk. So, Christian friend, come and see the view. What I am doing, you do not understand now, but you will know after this. Do you understand? This is our God, the servant king.